Welcome to The Public Storyteller. My name is Michael Stock with Dr. Karen Neal. Karen is affiliate professor at Florida Atlantic University and a professional storyteller. Hi, Karen.
Hello, Michael.
What do we have in store for today?
Michael, this is a special extended segment based on an event that was sponsored by the Boca Raton Interfaith Clergy Association on March 12th. It was called Our Stories of Immigration, An Evening of Tales, Tunes, and Tastes. It took place at B'nai Torah Congregation in Boca Raton. And the storytellers in order are Karen Nordlander, Dr. Bassem Al-Halabi, Norman Frajman, Roldane Plaisir, the Reverend Aram Marashlian, Liliana Kaplan Abramson, and Anita Sherman.
In 1957, our family had just moved from my beloved Brazil to Europe. I was a teenager, and I was madly in love with Elvis Presley. So my dream was not to move to Europe, but to move to the United States so that I can see Elvis Presley in concert. Well, moving forward, 1967, half of my dream comes through. I had finished my law school studies in Switzerland, and I wanted to do a master's degree in international law, and I was told for that you need to be fluent in English because most professors are coming from the United States. I knew Elvis Presley songs by heart. I did not know what they meant. So my mother was reading a Swedish newspaper and found an ad in the paper of a family in Alexandria, Virginia that was looking for a nanny for a year. I applied, I got the job on one condition. I was not allowed to wear miniskirts. So next step was to go to the US Embassy and fill out all the forms so that I could get my green card. And I did everything, and within 2 weeks, I was told, sorry, the Turkish quota is filled. So I went back to the embassy, and I tried to explain that in continental Europe, your nationality is that of the blood of your father. I'm a Swedish citizen, not Turkish. Well, it didn't work. But at that point, I found out that if you have a master's degree, there is no quota. So I redid all my forms because a law degree is considered a master's degree. And within a few weeks, I got my green card. And in December of 1967, here I am on a plane off to the United States. I landed in Dulles International Airport, which is international airport outside Washington, D.C., and I was picked up by Mr. Paradise. He was the father in that family. And we drove, and I got very nervous because we drove through a forest and more forest and more forest. Well, I had seen movies about the United States. It was either huge, tall buildings or big homes with big lawns and swimming pools. Well, here it was only forests. Later, I found out we had driven on the George Washington Parkway. So at the end of 68, I went back to Europe, spent 2 years studying, and then I came back to the United States. I got my bar exam, and I got a job as a lawyer at the World Bank. 1977, my mother is visiting. I get to buy two tickets almost in the front row for a live concert by Elvis Presley. And my mother had complained, while I was a teenager, my mother always complained that I had too many pictures on the wall, the music was awful, but anyway, she came with me. And guess what? At the end of the concert, Elvis had a new fan.
I was born in Damascus, Syria, one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world. I grew up in a very industrial family. When my father applied for his membership number in the Chamber of Commerce, he was number two in the city of Damascus. That's my father. When I joined the university during my first year at Damascus University, I knew it that I needed some more challenging environment. So my professors and some of my friends in 1980, actually, they told me, Bassem, you should seek some knowledge, some education abroad. Germany, France were very common at that time, but something in my heart told me, no, go to the United States. My parents said, Bassem, that's very far, like really far. I said, no problem, I can do it, I'm a man, you know, 20 years old, going very ambitious and so on. So actually, in a blink of an eye, I did it. I found myself in Athens, Ohio, in mid-December. From Damascus, a very vibrant city where you find people on every inch of the road, to Athens, Ohio, it was empty in December. So it was an amazing, amazing shock for me. So I started feeling the pressure. What did I do to myself? Oh my God, coming from such a huge family, 9 brothers and sisters, to no one is there. So anyway, I ate all the food that my mother packed in luggages. And then very soon I start washing my underwear and all my clothes and said, what did I do to myself? I was lonely like never before in my life. And I really start crying like a baby, and I start calling. And making phone calls at that time was very expensive. And writing letters, it takes forever. So I told my parents on the phone, I'm coming home, that's it. And in 6 months, basically, after 2 quarters of intensive English program, in 6 months, I went home. I went back to Syria, to Damascus. And believe it or not, I just happened to know that my mom, for the past 6 months, never stopped crying every day, and my dad was tired of it. And he told her, Dura, her name is Dura, I mean precious. He said, Dura, you need to stop crying. Your son is learning stuff. So the bottom line is, they pushed me back to go back to Ohio University because they felt like I am going to do it, and basically I showed them that I improved so much in English in 6 months. So here they go. They pushed me back, and I went back to Ohio. Now, during that difficult time at Ohio University, one thing I never forget, or one man basically, Mr. Jack. Mr. Jack was my English teacher, and I used to complain all the time. Mr. Jack, this is wrong. I say, what's wrong? Everything is wrong. The way people dress, wrong. The way people eat, wrong. The way the trees were, wrong. I say, what's wrong with the trees? I told them they are red and blue and orange and purple. I've never seen that. Trees are normally supposed to be green. And everything wrong, everything. The people, the way they dress, the streets were wrong. You say, what's wrong with the streets? They all go up and down. Athens, Ohio, amazing. It's all up and down, up, and imagine with the snow. I mean, that was a nightmare. So he told me, Bassem, listen, son, listen carefully. I'm going to teach you one word you should never forget in your life. So what is that, Mr. Jack? He said, things in the United States are not wrong. They are different. You got that? Told him, okay, yes, sir, I got it. So I start thinking differently. So people, the way they were dressed, I said, okay, they look different. Now they start looking beautiful instead of wrong. The trees with all these beautiful colors, I start seeing everything beautiful. So he really, with one word, changed my mindset.
Holocaust survivor, and it came to a point as to what to do with my life after I was liberated from extermination camps, losing all my family. I was in various DP camps, that's displaced persons camps in Germany after my liberation. I am old, but 16 years old, and I wanted to go and visit the only family that I had left alive, which were in the State of Israel. And then I found out that I have an uncle in the United States, and that changed my direction. I spent like 2 weeks going on a ship that's an eggshell on the ocean. And finally, we arrived with Doc about 3 o'clock in the morning on 57th Street in the city of New York on the West Side. My goodness, I see thousands of cars. I says, what did I get myself into? Don't people have sleep? Don't they have fun? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Where am I? Well, I tried to normalize my life, which was slightly difficult for me because I came here without the knowledge of the language and didn't know. And basically, when I saw a policeman, I got frightened looking in back just constantly. Now, this man had a gun on him, and the gun he's sometimes going to use and kill somebody. After being here a while, I realized that this gun is here to protect me. And believe me, it's the first time in my life that I ever experienced freedom.
So my father, he was born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. He did most of his schooling in Haiti. He learned English that could get him by. For example, he learned how to say, hi, how are you? My name is, I work at. When he got to college, he studied civil law and public administration, and then he got a job as a Red Cross representative. So with that job, they gave him a visa to travel back and forth from Haiti and the United States. My mother, the same way, she did most of her schooling in Haiti, and as she grew up, graduated from college, she got a job as the secretary within the government of Haiti, and with that, she obtained a visa as well to go to the United States whenever she wanted to travel there. And my parents met, they fell in love, got married in 1990. And within that year of their marriage, they had my first eldest sister. The following year, they had my second oldest sister. And when the year 1996 came, I was conceived. And my mother decided, you know what, I want to have my child in the United States. And my dad was like, why? And my mom said, well, it would be much easier with the paperwork. She'll be a U.S. citizen right off the bat when she's born. So my dad said, okay. A month before I was due, she flew to Brooklyn, New York, and she gave birth to a beautiful young lady. And after she gave birth to me, she got the okay to travel back to Haiti with me. So me and my family, we stayed in Haiti for 3 years. And my father went to my mother, and my father said, I want to live in the United States. And then my mother was like, why? And my father said, the government in Haiti is getting worse and worse as years progress. There's been a lot of kidnappings happening, so he was very afraid of the safety of me and my sisters. So my mother understood the issue, and she said, okay, let's move to the United States. So with their visas, they traveled, me, my sisters, my mother and father. We lived in Philadelphia with cousins for 5 years. And we lived in an apartment complex. We lived in the lower part of the apartment complex, and our cousins lived at the top. And it was great because what my parents would do is they would take lessons from my cousins, like 30 minute to hour sessions learning English and the American culture and how to purchase a home and how to purchase a car and how taxes worked. So it's funny because I kind of started becoming a tutor for my parents and my sisters, you know, speaking English to them a lot. But at the same time, I didn't know the Creole language very well. So my parents had to teach me Creole, and I had to teach them English. So we were going back and forth teaching each other like different languages, which was very funny.
It begins in 1915. It's the beginning of World War I. My father, who is 17, has been drafted into the Turkish army by the Turks. And Armenians were not allowed to go into the infantry or carry weapons. They were to do the menial jobs. My father was assigned to an Armenian doctor where it was winter and they were up in the mountains. The Turks were having troubles because they were getting frostbitten toes. So the doctor had to teach my father how to cut off the toes of the soldiers. A short time later, a message came to the Turkish officer who was in charge of this particular unit. And he didn't know how to read or write his own language. So he said to the doctor, would you please read this letter to me? And the doctor says, sure, I'll read the letter to you. So he takes a look at it. The letter in it has orders to kill the doctor and my father, and then to take the unit and transfer them somewhere else. But that isn't what the doctor tells the officer. He says, you are to allow Aram and I to go to our homes and then take the unit and move them to this other district. So he let the two of them go. My father went back to his home in Marash. The family had to hide him in a blanket factory, which was in their town. He worked there and hid there. In the meantime, Turkish soldiers came and they were rounding up all the Armenian men and they were going to put them on a train and send them out to the Syrian desert where they were going to leave them to die of starvation and thirst. So my grandmother, she said, I am going to save my Tare. She knows where my grandfather hid the gold. They never trusted the Turkish banks. So she got a small bag of gold. She goes to the Turkish mayor and she says to him, Abdul Efendi, I want you to write a letter with your name and your seal on it to take my Tare off the train. And he says, Zepur, I can't do that. He says, the rest of the government won't allow it. She says, oh, is that true? So she takes the gold and puts it right in front of his face. She says, now write. He writes the letter, heats the wax, puts his ring on it. So she takes the paper and she goes down to the station. A Turkish private knows she's an Armenian lady. He's ready to kill her until an officer sees that she's got this paper in her hand. She's holding it up. It's got the signature on there and the seal. He says, don't you touch her. Bring her over. He says, okay, lady, we're going to go from car to car. And sure enough, they found my grandfather. He said to them, lady, take your husband and your family and get out of this town because tomorrow morning there won't be one Armenian left alive. They went home. They put all the money in their clothes. They didn't take any baggage. And they went and marched and walked or wherever they could get a ride. They made their way to Palestine, which is now Israel. And it was there that my grandfather was able to take passage to the United States and was able to make it through Ellis Island. He had been a bootmaker. He ended up in Dorchester, Mass., opened up a store, and in 2 years' time, he made enough money to send back to bring the family home.
It was a coincidence that I was born the day the United Nations was formed. I was born from a Russian immigrant father that when he became Chilean, he was so proud because the passport didn't say place of birth. My mom was born in Chile. We grew up in a very nice home with a lot of things, love, family, and anytime I needed anything, because my dad was so well known in the community, he would say, call my friend, he will help you. When I got married, the year after, my husband was transferred to an assignment as a consultant in California at the same time that I realized that I was pregnant. I moved with him, but I was okay. I knew I was coming back. But what I never expected that he was gonna fall in love with the United States. We went back to Chile to have my son. We stayed there for 2 years, and I knew that my husband was planning moving back to the United States. So elections were coming. He didn't like one of the candidates, so he said, let's go. I said, what do you mean, let's go? Let's go. So October 30th of 1970, we packed and we left with my son Ronald to the United States. And my parents made me promise that my kids were gonna be bilingual, and every summer, my kids never went to camp. Their camp was going back to Chile to spend it with the grandparents. We arrived in Mexico because my sister lived there. And one of my uncles said to my husband, you know what, I have a contact in Chicago. They have an opening. Why don't you go for an interview? He went, he got the job. December 11th of 1970, my son and myself arrived in Chicago. Middle of the winter, no friends, no family. I cried every night. My husband used to travel 100% of the time. But I remember my dad's words saying, you have two choices, either cry or make it. And I said, maybe I should make it. Then one morning, while I was walking outside our complex with my son Ronald, there was a lady with a child, a little younger than my son. Her name was Judy, the baby was Mark. And the baby smiled at me, and she said, I can't believe it. Mark has never smiled to anyone. You must be very special. Well, they took us under their wing. Her husband was an attorney and helped us with all the barriers of immigrants. So time went by. My only American member of the family was born, my daughter Paula. My husband, his work has given him a training visa. But the problem with training visa that every time we wanted to get out of the United States traveling, we had to find an American embassy to renew the papers. So we had applied for green card. So at the same time that we were relocating to Florida, immigration said, your green cards are ready, but you have to go back to Chile to get it. We went back to Chile, completed all the paperwork, and they gave us this huge yellow envelope and said, do not open it. During the night, 9 hours traveling, I sat on the envelope. I was so afraid that the envelope was going to disappear. So we arrived to the United States. They call us to the side, this whole ceremony of what it means to have a green card. They opened the envelope and they gave us the green card. I didn't come to this country by choice. I was brought here by my husband. I didn't come to this country for a better life. I was high class in Chile. I'm just middle class here. I didn't come to this country for political reasons. But one thing I have to say to this country, thank you for making me the person I am. I have my own identity, I'm completely self-supported, and I don't have to ask for my dad's friends to be able to do things.
I was born in Kerala, India, and if you're not familiar with Indian geography, if you picture the Indian subcontinent, it's the southwesternmost state, and it's lush and tropical and beautiful. But I grew up in the United States, and I have this deep connection with the land of my birth and my home here. When I was about 3 or 4, that's when my parents immigrated to the United States and they settled in Lexington, Kentucky. And until I could join them, I lived with my maternal grandmother and my uncle in my mother's ancestral home in India. And it was a place, a town, where our family had been rooted for generations. And I remember that house when I was little so well, at my grandmother and my uncle's, those cool terrazzo floors and warm breezes just blowing in through open windows, the hum of ceiling fans at night, and the heavy thump of rain, especially during the monsoon seasons, and the scent of spices just wafting through the house all day while the food was being prepared. I didn't know the value of any of it for the world. I just knew that I really loved it. So when I was 5 years old, I immigrated to the United States to be with my mom and dad, and we lived in several homes in and around Lexington, and each one was home really and truly because I was loved. One of the greatest gifts my mom and dad gave me was transplanting me well from my home in India to my home in the United States. What I mean by that is they didn't try to raise me as if we all still lived in India. And this was so crucial because it allowed me to embrace my new home in the United States and to still love my home in India. So I could keep my feet and my heart in two places. So when I'm in the US and I say home, I mean India. And when I'm in India and I say home, I mean the United States. In Lexington, we had homes all around the orbit of the University of Kentucky. And that campus sort of became a home to me as well. My mom was a chemist and she worked at the university for many years. I worked in several of those labs and I got my first job at the medical library there. And we followed UK basketball religiously. 13 years ago, our feet led us to South Florida. And I remember coming to interview at St. Gregory's Episcopal Church, and we were walking around the campus of the church, and I look up and I see this beautiful mango tree. And immediately, I had this sense of homecoming. It was like being back in India. I felt this deep connection, connecting my two homes. We have the bananas, the palm trees, the coconuts, the bright flowers, and the warm breezes, the hot sun. It's perfect here as far as I'm concerned.
Anita Sherman, Liliana Kaplan Abramson, the Reverend Aram T. Marashlian, Roldane Plaisir, Norman Frajman, Dr. Bassem Al-Halabi, and Karen Nordlander. We've been listening to excerpts from Stories of Immigration, An Evening of Tales, Tunes, and Tastes. It took place on Monday, March 12th at B'nai Torah Congregation, presented by the Boca Raton Interfaith Clergy Association.
Thank you for bringing those stories to us, Karen. If our listeners would like to submit a story to the Public Storyteller, how can they do that?
Send me an email at cneil, C-N as in Nancy, E-I-L-E, at fau.edu.
Our website has contact information as well as archive stories at wlrn.org. Click radio and the Public Storyteller. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, Michael. See you next week.
Dr. Karen Neal is affiliate professor at Florida Atlantic University and a professional storyteller. My name is Michael Stock. The Public Storyteller returns next Sunday.